actually, when when I started, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to give this class, and Madhavendrapuri Prabhu asked me this morning, and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to talk about now? Because I already said everything that I wanted to say, you know. But as I began to think about it, actually the topic is really deep and vast, and now I have so many things, I don't even know where to begin. It's very funny. So, one thing, since the last class kind of ended up on, we were discussing loneliness and emotions, things like this, one thing I wanted to do is, I just published a book in Russia, and there's a couple chapters which deal with emotions in Krishna consciousness, which is, you know, it's a topic that I've never seen anyone write about, you know, maybe a little bit here and there. Prabhupada mentions in different places, but not, you know, as far as ISKCON is concerned in the modern day, you know, the contemporary context. I thought maybe what I can do is just read just a few, couple pages of that chapter, the beginning of it. And I wanted to talk about very practical things, some of my experiences, maybe some of your experiences, some have some discussion, and brainstorm something and talk about male and female traits, qualities, things like this. Since it is a topical issue about loneliness, because, you know, let's face it, I think that women are not only attracted to us because of the physical aspects. There's also the psychological, emotional aspects. I mean, I think everybody can appreciate their own mother, at least. And, you know, that there are some attractive, nourishing qualities of the woman. So, and unless those things are kind of fulfilled within us, although we may be sense-controlled, we may still need to fulfill those. And I think that we haven't tried enough, we haven't tried hard enough to fulfill those subtle needs within our own temples as brahmacharis, as men. And it seems that in order to avoid the feminine attraction to women, we've kind of completely avoided the turned off the feminine qualities. But if we, my theory at least, is that if we recognize and imbibe some of the positive feminine traits, then we won't need to go to women to get those traits. I haven't confirmed that this theory is true, but I think it sounds logical to me, you know. Because, in other words, a brahmachari goes to a woman for two things. One is for physical sense enjoyment, basically, that's for other reasons, and then the other one is for psychological, subtle sense enjoyment, emotional sense enjoyment, or emotional fulfillment, let us say, which is, I think, a valid need. Because if a man is a sannyasi for 20, 25 years, and then he gets married, then it's not that he's a sense enjoyer. Because if he was a sense enjoyer, if he couldn't control his senses, his sexual urge, then he probably wouldn't have made even 5 years as a sannyasi, right? So, now, it's just kind of like the scientific world beginning to recognize that there's something called consciousness, you know. So similarly, in devotional world, since we're modern-day Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we're also recognizing that there are kind of subtle or emotional needs, it seems. And we're just kind of on the break of this, you know, kind of thing. So anyway, let me read this just a couple chapters, listen. And then we'll have some exercises. Emotions and impersonalism. That's the first chapter of the emotional, there's two of them. Religion from the neck up. One of our congregational members in England coined this phrase in Rumford, actually. No, it wasn't John. The meaning is that many devotees, although knowing philosophy and performing spiritual duties and rituals, rarely exhibited any feelings. This, of course, is a subjective statement, a sweeping generalization, and one can find numerous devotees with fine feelings, genuine integrity, humility, and compassion. Still, this negative view has been leveled, means we've been accused by one of our own members that we're a little bit, we're living from the neck up. You understand what that means? It means that we're not living, we're denying everything from the neck downwards. You know, I mean, because the genital is also here and the heart is here. So these are the two things that get us into trouble. Right? More theoretically. Right, exactly. Only, theory and philosophy and analysis, discrimination, viveka, right? And not so much this. So below the neck there is the two organs, two important organs, the heart and the genital. So in order to avoid the pushings of the genital, we kind of like cut off everything from here down, so that we don't get into trouble, kind of, so to speak. So there's this heart. So the heart you have to deal with also. You can't just cut that off and just, horrible, I'm ahead, from here up only, horrible, Hare Krishna. People kind of, floating around the Hare Krishna temple like that. In the West, it's like that, I don't know. But if you ever go to the West, I think you're going to have some really shocking experiences. Yeah. Okay, let me continue. A god brother of mine, jetting to India, happened to sit next to a Christian pastor on the plane. In time, the pastor revealed that he had lived in one of our ashrams for a year or so. As the conversation developed, the devotee naturally became curious to know more about the pastor's experiences, and in particular, why he had left the Hare Krishna movement. The pastor glorified the devotees, offering them heartfelt appreciation for practicing what they preached. He was reticent to say anything negative or give his reasons for leaving. And he said that he had great respect for the devotees, seeing firsthand how they rose early, took cold showers, came together for early morning prayer and song, and seriously practiced celibacy. He was very respectful. My godbrother became even more interested to know why the pastor had left, and with more vigor asked him again. Relenting, the pastor said, "There wasn't enough fellowship for me, or brotherhood." Upon conducting many love and trust seminars, I found a similar phenomenon in our ISKCON communities. After exercises in open communication, devotees would often offer feedback, such as, "I'm so glad that you've conducted this seminar. I was able to deeply talk with this other devotee whom I'd seen for years, but I had never really spoken with before. I'm feeling so happy because I found a new friend. Thank you." I did this in Russia and in Eastern Europe, maybe love and trust seminar that I did starting from about 96, 97, I think. Huh? What do I do? I read some quotes that Prabhupada wrote in letters about love and trust. Then we break into groups and we ask the students what are the symptoms of a society that has love and trust? And we write all those symptoms down on the board. Right. I mean, each group comes up with a different list, and then we compile them all together. Then we ask the students, do you see these symptoms in our society? Or do you see the symptoms in your community and in other ISKCON communities? And then they have a discussion about that. And, then I ask them, what is your general opinion? And devotees, a lot of them say that there's love and trust, but there could be a lot more. Because if there wasn't any love and trust, there wouldn't be any ISKCON whatsoever. Because Prabhupada said that, our movement's based on love and trust. So then there must be some love and trust, because there's still an ISKCON. But many devotees felt that there could be a lot more. So then we have some exercises. I'm giving you a very brief, from what I can remember, how I used to conduct this seminar. Then we have some exercises to improve trust. Like, devotees get into a line. We have maybe six devotees standing in front, six devotees in the back, and they put their arms, the ones in front, they put their arms out, and the ones in back, and then the ones in the front have to fall backwards and trust that the guy behind them. And it can be scary for some people, Especially if you're on a marble floor. If you're on this floor, it would be very, really hard. Then there's another exercise. I haven't done this yet, but there's another exercise. This is in psychotherapeutic circles, where you get a circle of like 8 or 10 men, and one guy stands in the middle, and then he just kind of, and he's just kind of caught by the circle, and he just kind of bounces all around, from this side, to this side, to this side, and he just kind of, And he gradually feels the support of the people in the group. That's another one. And another one is devotees, they all pair up. Then I say, okay, now devotees pair up, sit back to back on the floor, right? And sitting on the floor like this. And then they have to lock their arms. Right behind them, and then they have to try to stand up together. So it's like, it's not so easy, Especially for ladies, it's almost impossible, because their bodies are not as strong. So then after we do that, that gets everybody really fired up doing these things, because especially in the temple room, where usually people don't do these things, So it kind of, in our movement, in the temple room, although there should be some reverence and, of course, respect for the deity, but usually what happens a lot of times in the West is a stiffness kind of enters into the temple room. People walk there, and they're in the temple room, they're kind of a little bit stiff, and they're a little bit afraid to express their feelings because there's other people who maybe they don't have conflicts with, and, may not appreciate their singing or their movements or so whatever, there may be some conflicts in the community. People come there, and it gets a little stiff. So when you do those exercises in the temple room, then it just breaks all of those, taboos, and the whole atmosphere changes. So the devotees start to feel more relaxed. And they also physically touched each other, which is important. Maybe we'll talk about that also a little bit. They physically touched each other, and so then I said, then I get them to pair up again, and I say, now we'll have another exercise of speaking, communicating, and one devotee, the two devotees, they're all in pairs separately, and then I say, you have to offer to the other devotee some neutral observation about his character. Like, you seem like a very serious person, you know, very dedicated, or you seem like a very friendly, open person, or you seem whatever, you know, just a neutral observation that you seem like a very gentle or a person, or a very intellectual person, anything like this. And then also find at least two qualities in that other devotee that you would like to imbibe, or something that you admire in that person. So this opens up. An interesting thing happens, actually. And I say, well, okay, we'll do this for 10 minutes. But an interesting thing happens is because the devotees are like, now they have to kind of honestly express their feelings about what they think about the other devotee. And I tell them not to talk about, or not to speak with someone that you're very close to, someone that you just know a little bit. And so they start opening up and they start talking. I let it go for about 20 minutes, because what happens is in the beginning they stand there and it's a little stiff. But after about 5 minutes, everybody's, you know, moving their arms and they're talking, they're going, and then you can see that everybody's really getting into a whole thing. After that, then I say, okay, it's finished. Now embrace your partner. Then I ask the devotees, so tell me, how did you like this seminar? What was your experience? Give me some feedback. I got this most amazing feedback from people. One devotee in Ljubljana, he said, when I embraced the other devotee, I felt my false ego explode. And there was in a place in Russia called Shochi, one lady in the back, she said, I've been seeing this other lady coming to the temple for 3 years now. And she lives outside, but I live in the temple. So I always thought she's not a serious devotee because she lives outside and I live in the temple. But when I spoke to her, I realized that she's more serious than me. And now we're good friends, you know. And then we've had a lot of these. There was one head pujari in Samara in Russia. And he said, I want to thank you very much because I saw this other devotee for 2 years and I just used to say Hare Bol to him in the hallway while we passed. But now I've had a chance to actually speak deeply with him and I've made a great friend, so I wanted to thank you for that. So, probably you don't have that problem here so much, in the West, some places are really, really bad. You know, it's like you can live in the temple for 2, 3, 4 years and see people and never even talk to them. And it's weird. You know, it's a little weird. So, it's not shocking. It's no wonder that people want to, you know, go and get married because they want to go talk to somebody who can appreciate them. In Vrindavan, I counseled a brahmachari. I think he was about a 10-year brahmachari, right? This one from Australia, the something 12-year brahmachari. And he said he was going to the MVT restaurant, and then this lady was serving him prasadam. A rather dangerous place for a brahmachari. they started talking. And then he was trying to see, he was asking me, do you think I should get married and like this? He said this lady told another devotee that she's in love with this man and da 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 da, and she admires him and da 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 da. And then gradually, this other devotee came to him and said, there's a girl that's in love with you. Do you want to know about it? And he said, no, no, no. But then after about a week, he came back and said, who is that person you're talking about? You know, because he was thinking about it so much. And then he said, yeah, this person. Because, and he told me honestly, he said, to know that somebody was in love with me was just like too much for my, because to know that somebody's like admires you and loves you, and I couldn't stop thinking about it, he said. And really, I couldn't stop thinking about it, because appreciation, and it's very important. So now, because our time's limited, but I wanted to ask you to give me, do we have a marker here? There are masculine and feminine qualities, right? Both men and women have negative qualities, and they both have positive qualities. You have a different color? Well, they're both black. Okay. So let me know, tell me what you think are, if any, positive feminine qualities in women. Affection. Okay. Or like affectionate, say we, right? That's it. Caring. Okay. Raise your hands. So, and I, tolerance. Okay. Any more?
Shyness.
Okay. Soft and gentle. Yes. Yes. Fine speech, that's what Krishna says in the Gita, right? Sincerity. Easily forgetting? Forgiving. Cooking. No, that's not a call. That's a skill. Any other qualities? I wrote down a few. About friendly. Right? Most women are friendly, aren't they? At least the ones that are friendly. Oops. Reserved. Supportive. Hey, that's a good one. They're supportive, right? Yeah. Supportive. I wrote that one then, too. Appreciative. You can think of your mother, maybe, you know? One that I wrote is that they're social, or they're, well, we wrote gentle. Nourishing, how's that? Nourishing.
Okay.
Loving, how about loving?
Did we write loving?
Caring, loving.
Okay,
so these are positive, right? Because Krishna also has these qualities, doesn't he? I think Krishna is the source of all qualities, isn't it? Or Radha and Krishna, right? So these are good things. So if a lady is, you know, fairly, you know, decent person, then she'll have some of these. To a certain degree, she'll have some of these qualities. So these are, you know, some things which are, I would say, you know, maybe genuine needs of any person that, especially men, or even other ladies that may go to a lady to have some relationship with a lady to get some of these things. Right. I think that we could say it would be a genuine need of an individual, an emotional need. So. So I guess the question is, you know, can we get these, you know, from each other? Right? And I think that it's possible. But it means that, first of all, we have to acknowledge that it's a genuine need, first thing, right? Then, right, acknowledgement. Acknowledge. Then we have to kind of somehow foster these things within our own devotees. And then kind of exchange them, you know. There has to be some exchanges. They say that, you know, in the ISKCON temples, you know, in the beginning days, that the temple president was very fatherly. Usually there was like a grihastha couple. And they would even read Krishna book to the devotees every night and tuck them in bed and, you know, this kind of thing. Also, once Ravindra Sarup, who was made a temple president only after like 1 year being in the movement, he didn't know what is a president supposed to do. So he wrote a letter to Prabhupada, you know, what are my duties as a president? So Prabhupada wrote a whole list, you know, make sure the books are distributed, make sure the deity is, service is taken care of, make sure there's distribution of prasad, make sure the prasadam's good for the devotees, make sure the books are going out, keep the counts, keep the temple clean, da-da-da-da. He wrote a whole list. But at the top of the list, he wrote, make sure the devotees are happy. You know. So Prabhupada saw that also that there were some genuine social needs, say, you know, for our devotees.
Should I switch off then? Change me over to this one then?
I don't know, should I keep reading this? Okay, anyway, I'll just summarize. I tell the story that in the temple, I was in London, and devotees walking around during the japa period, and one devotee, he stopped in front of me, he bent over, he took a hold of my arm, lifted up my arm, he looked at my watch, and then he put my arm back down without looking at me in the eye and without saying anything. And then he walked away. Yeah. You know, I mean, it never happened before or after that, you know, in 26 years. It only happened once. But still, it happened once, right? So, you know, Socrates says that you can judge a society by one member, right? So, you know, as I give this as a funny example to show how there's impersonalism in our movement to a certain degree. Because, I mean, you know, let's face it, we come from impersonal, especially Western people come from an impersonal background. And now, you know, I don't know, in India people may also be impersonal sometimes. So, in any case, I think whatever culture, the impersonalism is a kind of general disease of the conditioned soul. Doesn't matter what culture you're from. So, then I ask, then I give another example that I was teaching in Bhaktivedanta Manor for about 7-8 years, and I started noticing a peculiar phenomenon amongst the students, that the students who had been in the temple in the ashram for less than a year, when I gave the class, when I made a joke, they would laugh. When I spoke very harshly and seriously, you know, Prabhupada said, "You rascal!" And, you know, told them some story, and then they would react. And then if I said, "Yes," and then Krishna and Balaram went into the forest, then they would all, they were, you know, in other words, they were alive, you know, they were with me, you know. emotionally, and their whole being was, they were expressive of their feelings, you know. But the devotees who had been in the ashram for 3 years or more, they were like, you know, they didn't express their feelings, really. As, you know, some of them did, but it was very much more like when you're playing poker, you're not supposed to show any expression so that the guy doesn't know what cards, you know, if you have three aces, right, you're not supposed to show any feelings. So I began to wonder, you know, what are we helping these people spiritually? And I write, of course, in ISKCON, you know, we teach people deity worship, kirtan, and so many good things, which are undisputably wonderful. And I'm not criticizing, but why the dullness? Why did this happen? And then I begin to analyze in the rest of the chapter. I say that really I can't really fully say why this is, but I give three or four different reasons, and there's no time to get into that, but because it's a whole 25-page chapter. So I think that at least if we can accept the premise, you know, that we see that it's happening. You know, there have been maybe almost 7 sannyasis who fell down, who've been sannyasis for, you know, more than 15, 20 years in the last 4 years or 5 years, right? And although, I mean, even one of them was a Bengali sannyasi, Nitai Chan Swami, right? He left his sannyas ashram just last year. And he was a Pakka sannyasi, you know, a lot of shlokas, especially Bengali shlokas, you know, and he was a good preacher. He still is a good preacher, but he wasn't able to maintain his sannyas ashram, his celibacy, because of this reason, you know, one of the reasons. I mean, there may be so many, for each individual, there may be so many variations of reasons, but, you know, I think we could possibly conclude in a general way that if he or others had more fellowship, more close friendship with other God brothers, then probably wouldn't have had that problem. You know. So, you know, like Prabhupada said, you know, a bundle of sticks is hard to break. You know, if we're together and if we're actually open and friendly and supportive and gentle and da da da, all of these things, which women are, then we will support each other, right? These are also, you know, qualities of Vaishnavas, right? Isn't it? I mean, maybe except for shyness, but devotees are also shy in a sense that they don't want to put themselves forward. They're humble, right? So humility for a man is the same as shyness for a lady, I would say, right? So I think what I'm trying to say that there are we need to consider these points and make some adjustments within our movement, and this will help us to remain fixed in our renounced ashram, whether it's brahmachari, vanaprastha, or sannyas, because all of them don't associate with women. I'm a vanaprastha, so I have the advantage of having gone through brahmachari ashram 10 years and 12 years as a grihastha, and now 5 years as a vanaprastha, almost 6 years as a vanaprastha. And I also have lived in India, and I've lived in the West. I've lived in about 8 different countries, actually, so I have the experience. Okay, some questions and some discussion. I have a whole list of things. I didn't even get to 10% of them, so. Huh? Saturday, I'm going to be in Pune. But I'll come back on... maybe on Tuesday next week we can continue, because I have a lot of different topics here. some questions, comments, and let's have some discussion, okay?
Thanks. This is good. For number two, fostering, could you elaborate a little bit on that?
On what?
You have acknowledge, foster, and exchange.
That was just what came into my mind now. But, I mean, as far as my experience is that being ISKCON for 26 years, I haven't had any, I've never been to a seminar or a class where we discuss these things. Never. So that means the first thing we have to do is acknowledge this philosophy. Because really, we're kind of like living in denial, in a sense. Not totally, but to a certain degree, we're living in denial. I mean, come on, let's face it. How many sannyasis have to fall down until we realize that, hey, we got a problem here, man. You know, let's face this problem. Why not? Are we afraid? You know. So first, let's face it, that there's a problem. Because there shouldn't be so many people falling down. I mean, Nittai Chan also, he was living in Radhakund. Come on, it's not, you know what I mean? Not. First we should acknowledge something. Like, one GBC sannyasi guru told me, after Harikesh Prabhu fell down, he said, it's bizarre. We haven't even discussed amongst ourselves in the GBC anything about him. We haven't analyzed or discussed openly what was his problems. Were there any things that we could have done? Are other people having the same problems? What were the problems? You know what I mean? There was no analysis of Harikesh. He just dropped down and everyone just went, whoop. Where did he go, you know? And then we just kind of went on like nothing ever happened, really, you know? But then, you know, Vipramukha Swami, and then Jagadish, this Nittai Chan, there's so many, Ishwar Maharaj, all these sannyasis, they got married. Somaka Maharaj, you know, Abhay Charan, right? So many. Huh? Nityadita Prabhu. And they're, you know, it's not like they're evil men or that they're sensual rascals, you know. They're sincere devotees. Most of them are better preachers and whatever, devotees than myself. That's how I feel. So how could they, you know, what's going on? So that's the first thing, is that let's acknowledge what's going on. Let's look at it. At least let's talk about it, you know. We may draw wrong conclusions, but at least we should try to think, you know, what's going on. Then the second thing is to try. So when we realize that these things are important to brahmacharis and vanaprasthas and sannyasis, these qualities, then maybe, you know, maybe that's part of what we need to foster amongst ourselves in our interrelationships. First of all, within our own self. Let us acknowledge that being gentle and loving and nourishing is you know, we're supposed to be Vaishnava. And komala bhakti means komala, means soft and tender. The more advanced you are, the more soft and gentle and tender and loving you're supposed to become. Not that you become more hard and callous. I mean, callous in one way, that you realize you're not the body. Now, if we get into a whole other discussion, Prabhupada exhibited both of these qualities. Like, once he was in Hyderabad, I believe, driving in a car, he saw people standing in line at the bus stand. And he looked down and tears started coming down his eyes. And he said, they have to wait so long. Prabhupada was feeling compassion even for the people waiting for the bus. Come on, you know, just think how soft his heart was. And on the opposite, I have a lot of examples of this now, but we don't have much time. Prabhupada also, another time, he was driving in a car somewhere in South India, I think it was Madras, and there was an accident on the road where there was a man and a woman walking on the street, and the husband got flattened by a truck, by a lorry, and he was just completely like a pancake on the cement. And all it was some blood there. you know, and some bones. The guy was just totaled. And the wife was there like, you know, you can imagine how her face was, you know. She was screaming at the top of her lungs like, like this, and the car drove by, and you know, Hari Sari, and you know, the driver, there was maybe Pradyumna, they were in the car, and they looked and they saw this mess on the ground, and they saw the woman's face. She was like, and they just went, ooh, you know, they and Prabhupada just looked down and nothing. He was completely aloof from the whole thing. He didn't say, you know, oh, horrible, you know. He would just look down and then just completely like this. So anyway, we can see that the Vaishnava is Rajad Api Kotorani Mridjuni Kusumad Api, right? That he's both hard like a thunderbolt and soft like a rose. Lokacetanam chetangsi konu vigatam ishvaraha. So who can understand the Vaishnava? So it seems that we like to kind of stress the hard like a thunderbolt part, but soft like a flower, that's also there. So these things have to be understood in a deeper way, I think. That's my point. Because on the material level, a person has emotions. And on the spiritual level, he also has emotions. And in between, the emotions and the mind are gradually changing proportionately to his advancement. So it's not black and white. There's many gray areas in between the material emotions and the spiritual emotions called bhava bhakti. It's not that just one day you wake up and you're on bhava bhakti. You know, you go through all of the stages, nishta, ruchi, asakti, and like this. And as you go to all of these, and in each stage there are finer stages. So as you progress, your mind and intelligence and your emotions also become spiritualized. So if you don't use them now, when are you going to start to use them or acknowledge them? The softness part and the emotion part and the supportive, nourishing, loving, gentle part. It has to start at some point or another. You're not just going to wake up and then just start crying in ecstasy that you love Krishna. There has to be a development, a culturing of bhakti, of the softness, and all of these things that come. And we have to allow them. Actually, we should encourage them. But at least we should allow them to be expressed. You know, in the Nectar Devotion says to cry before the deity is an offense. But Prabhupada also said that another time, he said that if you're crying, you know, and you're in the temple, you're crying, the devotees will understand you're crying for Krishna, it's okay. You know? Because crying before the deity is an offense when you come before the deity and say, oh, I smashed my maruti. I lost 1 lakh of rupees. You know, that means that it's an offense because you're right. You're putting yourself in the center, you know. But if you're crying because you love Krishna, then he's in the center and it's not an offense. Huh? There's a difference. That's the reason why it's considered to be an offense to cry before the deity, because people come, you know, my wife left me. I saw a guy in London like that, you know, an Indian gentleman, you know, and he was, you know, his wife left him, he was sitting there, you know, crying. You know. So, you know, that's not good, that's an offense, actually. But if you're crying that you love Krishna and how Krishna is so merciful to you, and you know, and all of these other things, and tears come to your eyes and you cry, that's good. So Krishna has to be the subject, that's the point. So then once we foster these things in ourselves, then we need to exchange them and support each other in being Vaishnavas and being soft and nourishing and supportive like this. Because when we go to the spiritual world, that's how it is. And everybody's very much, you know, supportive. Just like I read last night, the gopis who are running out of their houses to meet Krishna, they would fall on the ground fainting, and they'd have saliva and tears, you know, caked to their face when the stuff dries on the face, you know. And then the other gopis would pick them up and carry them. Come on, let's go see him, let's go see him. Right? They'd just, leave her laying on the ground, you know. Right? They would pick them up and say, come on, let's go. It's a very supportive atmosphere, you know. So that's what we need. Still, doesn't matter, some of us may need, have, you know, because it's rare, you know, the percentage is that most brahmacharis get married. That's a fact. But the percentage could be of brahmacharis remaining, you know, or going on to sannyas and being really successful sannyasis. The percentage could increase a lot more than it is now. Let us say that. Okay, anyway, I'm talking too much. Some questions? More questions? Yes?
On a practical level, considering the kind of socio-religious fabric we are in within ISKCON, the kind of services which are allotted and the kind of responsibilities brahmacharis take. So, could you give some suggestions on what kind of changes could be incorporated to develop these qualities more? Because many times, many of the services are centered around getting things done and meeting targets. And these qualities seem to be a little different, which do not really, you know.
In the army, we don't see these qualities so much, right? What to do? I don't know. Well, I think that just by having a few classes and discussing them, your brahmachari class is a forum by which you could develop. When, you know, you kind of clear away a lot of stuff from yourself by just doing the regular practices, gradually you come to a point when you find the kind of seva that really helps you a lot. It's your, you know, speciality. And it's good to gradually, you know, to after some years, first 5 years probably you're not going to know about it. But after that, there should be some thought and some discussion about that. And that has to do with creativity. And creativity just, you know, means that, you know, we just call it being enlivened, being, you know, enthusiastic. It's part of the devotional energy, this Kriya Shakti. And it's very helpful. It gives you pleasure. You get a pleasure from that. I wanted to have some more discussion, but I think next time, maybe on Tuesday or Wednesday next week, we can do something more about this kind of topic. Okay. Any last comments or last points? Do you think we're going in the right direction here, or yeah? Do you more or less agree with some of the things that, or most of the things I've said? Yeah. Yeah, one more point. What's that? Yeah, Ishtagosti. Well, you know, amongst yourselves. How many times do you have this class?
Every day.
Every day.
Except Friday and Sunday.
Friday and Sunday, yeah. So 5 days a week. So at one of those classes, you can have some further discussion, ishtagoshti, or, you know, open discussion. That's practical. I think it'll help a lot. And we can raise the percentage of successful renunciates. Yeah.
Maharaj, Radhanand Maharaj gave us this three principle for surviving in the Brahmacharya Ashram.
Oh, wait a minute. Just hold one second. I wanted to tell you that the first time I met Radhanath Swami in New Vrindavan, he embraced me. First time. Right? And I thought, wow. You know, I just felt great. I felt, you know, this person cares about me, he appreciates me, or, you know, better to be embraced by a devotee than to have to go to, you know, to, if you're a renunciate, then to have to leave that just so that you can get some appreciation and some care, some love from a, you know what I mean? I mean, Radhanath Swami is a very good example. And this was like 82. I think he had just taken sannyas just a few months before. And he was he's a very loving person. And that's why, you know, his project here is very successful. And that's why a lot of you are, you know, feeling satisfied. Because his nature is like that. But we should be like that. That's basically what I'm saying. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, he said three principles which are very important for living in a Brahmacharya Ashram.
And what's important?
Living in the Brahmacharya Ashram, these three principles he said. One is, same what you're talking, care and affection from fellow devotees and proper sadhana. And third is preaching, right? Or cleanliness.
Cleanliness.
He said, these three principles, he said, you should try to imbibe in your spiritual life.
Right.
Cleanliness, yeah.
Cleanliness, care and affection, and?
Proper sadhana.
Sadhana.
Which includes reading a Prabhupada's books. Also.
Yeah, they should all help and support each other. They're all connected.
Yeah.
They're not disconnected things. They're all part of the same package. That's how I see it. You know, because when you do sadhana properly, your heart becomes soft. You know, that's what's supposed to happen, and we're doing it in the proper way. You know, because Krishna is the most soft. You know. When he met Gopakumar, he fainted on the floor, and he was crying. How more soft can he be? You know. Okay, I think so. We've made the points. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Argumentative. Too sensitive. I mean, kind of like self-centered sensitive kind of thing. Is that what you mean? Too sensitive. Huh? Demanding, lusty. Yeah, okay. Demanding. Lusty. Rude. Okay. Anything else? Any other? Okay. Huh? Okay. That's a pretty good list.
So we can see that women have good and bad traits, and it kind of boils down to the individual lady, and man, of course, also, that every person will have some bad traits and some good traits, a mixture. The more bad traits they are, the more undesirable is their association. And the more good traits, then the more desirable or favorable for bhakti also. That might be considered, an obvious thing, but when teaching or writing, one should state the obvious, just for clarification. We're looking at the statements made by a woman herself in the Srimad Bhagavatam by Urvashi on the 9th canto, chapter 14. Urvashi said, "My dear king, you are a man, a hero. Don't be impatient and give up your life. Be sober and don't allow the senses to overcome you like foxes. Don't let the foxes eat you." In other words, you should not be controlled by your senses. Rather, you should know that the heart of a woman is like that of a fox. There is no use making friendship with women. Prabhupada's purport. Janikapandit has advised, Vishvaso navakartavyam strishu raju kuleshu cha. Never place your faith in a woman or a politician. Unless elevated to spiritual consciousness, everyone is conditioned and fallen. What to speak of women? That's better, thank you. And who are less intelligent than men. Women have been compared to shudras and vaishyas, shudra vaishyas tata shudraha. On the spiritual platform, however, when one is elevated to the platform of Krishna consciousness, whether one is a man, woman, shudra, or whatever, everyone is equal. Otherwise, Urvashi, who was a woman herself and who knew the nature of women, said that a woman's heart is like that of a sly fox. If a man cannot control his senses, he becomes a victim of such sly foxes. But if one can control the senses, there is no chance of his being victimized by sly fox-like women. Chanika Pandit has also advised that if one has a wife like a sly fox, he must immediately give up his life at home and go to the forest. Mata yasya grihe nasti bharya chapriya vadini aranyam tena gantavyam yataranyam tata griham. Krishna conscious grihastas must be very careful of the sly fox woman. If the wife at home is obedient and follows her husband in Krishna consciousness, the home is welcome. Otherwise, one should give up one's home and go to the forest. Hitvatmam patam griham andhaku pambanam kato yadharim ashita. One should go to the forest and take shelter of the lotus feet of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Next verse. Urvashi continues, women as a class are merciless and cunning. Merciless, that's another quality you can write there. They cannot tolerate even a slight offense. For their own pleasure, they can do anything irreligious, and therefore they do not fear killing even a faithful husband or brother. Prabhupada's commentary. King Purarava was greatly attached to Urvashi, yet despite his faithfulness to her, she had left him. Now, considering that the king was wasting his rarely achieved human form of life, Urvashi frankly explained the nature of a woman. Because of her nature, a woman can respond to even a slight offense from her husband by not only leaving him, but even killing him if required. Sadhu Sabdhan. Sadhu Sabdhan. Therefore, in the material world, unless women are trained to be chaste and faithful to their husbands, there cannot be peace or prosperity in society. Does anyone have a pen I can write with? Just extra pen? So I can take some notes as my mind is starting to import some different ideas. More stories. Verse. Women are very easily seduced by men. Therefore, polluted women give up the friendship of a man who is their well-wisher and establish false friendship among fools. Well, I'm getting all these ideas and different examples. I forgot. Indeed, they seek newer and newer friends, one after another. Purport. Because women are very easily seduced, the Manusmita enjoins that they should not be given freedom. A woman must be always protected, either by her father, husband, or elderly son. If women are given freedom to mingle with men like equals, which they now claim to be, they cannot keep their propriety. The nature of a woman, as personally described by Urvashi, is to establish false friendship with someone and then seek new male companions, one after another, even if this means giving up the company of a sincere well-wisher, which means her husband, usually. Okay. So that, I mean, there's a lot of other places in the Bhagavatam where you can read this kind of information. But this was probably the most dramatic. So, interesting to read this. Now we'll give some elucidations, illustrations on some of these points. I remember, and the Bhaktivedanta Manor, maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, there was one Indian devotee who came there. I forget, I think he was from Orissa or Bengal. And he was serving in the temple. And then he he decided to marry, and he found a young lady in the temple. She was actually the daughter of a devotee also, and she was also engaging in devotional service and so forth in the kind of in the community. And he started a relationship with the lady. Simultaneously, he wrote a letter to his Guru Maharaj to ask for permission and to inform him. His Guru Maharaj was very displeased and warned him that you're Indian and now you're marrying a Western lady. They have a different culture and they have different samskaras, and it's better if you want to marry someone, you should marry an Indian lady from your own country, or from your own state even, you know, and class. So, but anyway, his heart was already devoted to this lady, deeply, and he couldn't retract his heart. He was a soft-hearted person, I think. And but then suddenly the girl decided that she didn't want to marry him. And he was absolutely devastated emotionally and psychologically for weeks and even months afterwards. I thought it was interesting. That happens a lot because... And he couldn't actually even understand how it was that she rejected him, because obviously he felt that he had true love for her and that he had her benefits in mind. But she very easily just rejected him without a care, without even a second thought. She was not lamenting, you know, walking around the temple, like this. But he was. So that, I thought that was just something that came up into my mind while I was reading this. And it was obvious, although I wouldn't say that she was a fox, but I would say that she wasn't quite as sensitive. Let us say that she wasn't quite as sensitive as he was. And he had a kind of illusion or misconception that he thought that she would reciprocate with him on the same level. In other words, he kind of projected on her that she must feel the same way about me as I feel about her. And this is a very common kind of projection of illusion that can happen with men or women. But atmanam manyate jagat. We always project upon others what we ourselves are thinking, how we feel, we project upon others. So he was absolutely shocked. And he came to me for consolation, for counseling, and for, you know, some emotional support, so to speak. But this person, I mean, he was really, really devastated. He couldn't do anything for weeks. He was just like walking around in a daze. Very heavy illusion, I think. I should also mention as a side point that I've seen, in my experience, many Indian devotees, when they go to the West, I would say probably 90% or more of them become totally bewildered by the material energy, because Western material energy is maybe 100 times stronger than the material energy in India. So once they kind of enter into that, they just get completely sucked up into the material energy, including the Western women, who kind of look nice on the outside. But there may be something completely different, unexpected on the inside. Which I also experienced when I was a young man, and I was also naive and foolishly fell in love, you know, with some girl. And, you know, she... And it's happened to me different times, but in one severe case, a lady ended up going with my friend, just kind of dumping me and going with my friend. And I was like similar to the Indian boy at that time. I was maybe 17 years old, something like that. Before I became a devotee when I was 21. And I had at least 40 or 50 girlfriends before I became a devotee. I must honestly admit to you. So I have a lot of experience, you know. And plus I could tell you some pretty wild stories, but I don't want to shock you too much. And also I was married, and my wife, although she was a pretty good devotee, but at the same time she ended up marrying someone else, falling in love with a brahmachari in the temple and kind of just, you know, leaving me and going to him. So, as Prabhupada mentioned, and he's quoting from Chanakya, and that when the woman is fox-like, then the man should just leave the home and go to the forest. So anyway, that even without my even having been too much aware of this injunction, I naturally did that. I went to the forest in Russia, in Moscow, and started teaching Bhakti Shastri in Russia. Then later I saw, oh, I have followed that injunction exactly. Yes, that's very nice. If you want to interrupt me and comment or say something or ask a question, you can just raise your hand during the discussion here. I'm just kind of throwing things up. Maybe some more modern day examples. Very recently, even right before I came to India in October, it was in September, a devotee acquaintance of mine in Moscow, a Russian man, young man, who is well-to-do. He has his own flat in the wealthy area of Moscow. Can everyone hear me? He was married to a young, pretty girl who was also a devotee. She was actually a model. And she would get invitations to go to London or Tokyo and, you know, model clothes and things like this. Tall and pretty face. Her pictures were seen on the billboards in Moscow for various kinds of women's products or something like this. So she was a pretty lady. And he was a well-to-do man, a musician, and a kind of cultural festival organizer. That's what he did for his job. And suddenly, well, they were actually planning to get married, they were devotees, and this woman was just swept away also. It just happened, and he was also devastated. Because they had known each other for maybe something like 10 years. And they were living together for, you know, 10 years or something like this. It was almost like they were married, actually. And they were, because they had just become devotees, so they were planning to get married. And so then the lady just somehow, she was carried away by, influenced by some other male friends of hers. No doubt she was also proud that she was so beautiful, like she was a model. And she started thinking that she could get maybe a better man, perhaps. And she just dumped her, you know, devotee future husband. And very easily, you know, also. He was also devastated and came to me. I always end up getting these people somehow. They come to me for counseling, you know. And maybe Krishna's trying to, you know, you know, teach me something. And it happens quite often, you know, especially in the West. And as you know, you know, especially Indian women are becoming more influenced by the Western culture, especially in Bombay, which is the doorway to the West. Or you could say Bombay is the doorway to India, but you could also say it's the doorway to the West. So, so again, a word of caution about this kind of thing. We see that women are also influenced very much by... Well, let's say just another superficial example. Just before coming here, there was a woman from Yugoslavia who was an initiated devotee. She has a son, and she has a husband. But yet, when she saw the dynamic mridanga player in the Vrindavan temple, she fell in love with him. And she spoke to him in the beginning of this year, and she said, "Please forgive me, Prabhu. I know that, you know, you're a brahmachari, but I just find it very difficult to control my senses when I look at you, and please forgive me." And then later, in September or October, like when you were all on yatra, she wrote a love letter to him. She still wasn't able to control her love. And she wrote a love letter to him saying so many things that, you know, she hopes to have some future relationship with him and etc. Even though she's a married lady and she has a boy, a son. So this boy immediately approached her spiritual master, a sannyasi, who was in Vrindavan at that time, and he told him, and you know, I guess showed him the letter even, and somehow diffused all of that energy and so forth. So they kind of worked it out. But it was shocking, you know, you can imagine, you know. A married woman with a child and a husband, and you know, their relationship is still, they live together and so, and then she does such a thing. And she's a devotee of some kind, anyway. So anyway, beware of love letters. As you may be also aware, somebody told me, I didn't speak to Prahlad myself, Sri Prahlad was here just recently. He mentioned to another devotee that, just kind of confidentially, that when he decided to get married and put on white, you know, he's preaching in Poland, and there's a lot of disciples of Indradumna Maharaj, young ladies, you know, and he's kind of famous, you know, as a kirtan leader and a preacher and so on. So when he decided to get married, there was like a big queue of women, you know, like 100 women that wanted to marry him. Something like this, you know. I don't know if it was 100, but a big queue was, you know, waiting, you know. So women are very much impressed by someone who's famous. And they're very much influenced by this and can be carried away. If a man who's, even if they're married, if a man who's famous kind of shows some interest in them, that, you know, that woman could be carried away by that woman. Prabhupada said that women are easily seduced. I experienced this when I was a young man living in New York before I was a devotee. And at a certain point, my house became like the place for all the big parties, you know, drinking and smoking and so forth, in that little town where I was living. And it became the popular place for all of the, you know, well-known and popular kind of, you know, young men and women. And I was inviting people and having big parties in my house. And then suddenly I became very popular. And then I noticed that suddenly, like, all these women started approaching me, you know, for illicit romance. And I thought that was very interesting. I didn't know that, actually. I was maybe 16 or 17, something like that. But I was kind of, you know, I observed it. Oh, it's interesting that before I was popular, I didn't have any women coming after me, you know. But after I became popular by having these big parties, then all these women became interested in me. Or at least I thought me, but not really me, but just the kind of image that now was being projected by me. You know, so it's not they really love you, but they love what you represent or what you stand for, like this. So that the idea of projection again comes up in our conversation. Often material love is a kind of projection on the next person, hoping that person will fulfill my desires in some way, whether it's social desires, financial desires, psychological desires, emotional desires, but it's a projection, hopes in the heart of the individual on the other person. And then when a man, as I mentioned, there was one Australian devotee in Vrindavan, when a man hears that a woman loves him, he becomes like, you know, really, you know, devastated. He becomes emotionally disturbed because he thinks that someone loves me, finally, after all these years, you know. Someone appreciates me, you know. But actually the woman doesn't appreciate him or even know him at all. But rather, she's projecting something. Oh, this person can fulfill my desires in this way, in that way. And then, you know, and then becomes interested in that person. And then when the man hears about that, the man's rather naive, innocent, simple, maybe sentimental. And then he becomes completely crushed and devastated by and controlled by the simple woman saying, I'm in love with you, like this. But it's complete illusion, total and utter illusion. I've had this experience many times, and I've had counsel devotees many times in ISKCON and outside and have the same experience. And even if we go to rather pious women, even Indian women, we find basically the same truth. It's not really any different, although there may be some, there may be more cultured and more sophisticated in the way they do it. But it's basically the same thing. Srila Prabhupada's wife also exhibited some unsavory characteristics. She was very stubborn, and she didn't want to assist him in his preaching. She was unsubmissive, basically, you know. Although she didn't, you know, go to any other man, as in a Western woman, but she didn't really assist him and try to follow him in an obedient, submissive way that a woman should be to her husband. And even she sold Prabhupada's books, Bhagavatams, just to get some tea biscuits. And that was the last straw, you know, for Prabhupada. And then he thought, that's it. Then he left. He left the house. Even if you go back to South India, and you go back 1,000 years ago, Ramanujacharya experienced the same thing with his wife, Rakshakambal. If you look in the history of Ramanujacharya, Rakshakambal also insulted the wife of the guru, Mahapurna, while she was getting water from the well. And some of the water from the other lady's bucket spilled into her bucket. And because she was from a higher Brahmin family, she was insulted by that. Can you imagine, you know, how caste conscious, you know, people can be. And so she shouted and spoke very harsh, insulting words to the wife of the guru. And so when Mahapurna Prabhu heard this, he thought, now it's time to leave. So he packed his things with his wife and he left from Kanchipur. And then when Ramanuja came back to the house, he saw that his Gurudev's belongings were gone, and he was gone, his wife was gone. So Ramanuja asked his wife, Rakshakambal, where is Mahapurna? He said, well, somehow, I don't know why, but they became upset and they left. Well, what happened? Well, I don't know why she became upset, but she spilled some of the water from her bucket in my bucket, and I told her that this wasn't right, and I told her that this was, you know, now I have to fill my bucket again, and you know. And then you know, Ramanuja, he said something like, just by looking at your face, I am committing so many sins. And just by looking at your face. And he walked away, he was disgusted. Anyway, he came back later, and he decided, this is it, I'm finished. I'm going to take sannyas, get away from this whole thing. So he wrote a fake letter as if from his father-in-law. My dear Rakshakambal, please come to our village. Your mother, your sister is getting married, and your mother is requesting your assistance in the wedding, da-da-da-da-da. Signed, your loving father, Vishnu Das, or whatever it was, I don't know, you know. And so he gave this letter to a Brahmin and asked him to deliver it to Rakshakambal. So then she got the letter. Oh, there's going to be a wedding, wonderful. You know. And so when Ramanuja came back, when Ramanuja came back, she said, "Oh, darling, my sister's getting married and Mama's inviting us to come to the village." And he said, "Oh, that's very nice. But you go first. I'll come after a day or two because I have to finish some business." And he sent her on her way. And he was now finished, you know. So then he went to a local lake, sat down and took sannyas, you know, in the front of a picture of his guru, I think. Something like this. He took sannyas, Ramanujacharya. So, you know, it's like, even if you go back 1,000 years, and even if you, this probably couldn't find a more pious woman, really, than Raksha Kumbhal. She, you know, married, she, Brahmin family, high-class Brahmin family, married to Ramanujacharya, living in South India, you know, around, you know, the 11th century, right? Something like that. And still, what kind of woman was she? She was so insulting and proud and arrogant and envious and had all these bad qualities. It's an interesting point. So, again, sadhu sabdhan. You know, you should be careful what you're getting into. Sadhu sabdhan. So I'm saying it properly? My Hindi pronunciation is lacking indeed. So there are many negative traits. So anyway, this is the major illusion that actually it's natural to want to give your heart to someone. That's natural. To want love. It's natural also to want to give your heart to a very loving, soft, gentle, sensitive, and beautiful person. Right? But who is that soft, loving, gentle, beautiful person? So actually the material woman is not a soft, loving, gentle, beautiful person. And once she gets hold of your heart, she can just like this, you know. No. And then you're left, you know. Yeah, without a heart, you're just kind of ripped out from your chest, you know. So the idea is that we should want to we should redirect that propensity to offer our heart to and develop love for that sweet, loving, kind, and beautiful person, to Radha and Krishna. And even if you feel that I should offer it to a feminine, beautiful person, then we should offer it to Srimati Radharani. Because she will never... She wouldn't do that. Never. She will accept the service and not only that, but it's eternal loving relationship with Radha and Krishna. When you offer your heart to them, they very carefully keep that, and they treasure it eternally. And then there's this beautiful, loving exchange between that soft, gentle, loving, sweet, and beautiful person and you, eternally, in the spiritual realm. So there is a need in of the heart for this type of thing. So as much as we can try to redirect that propensity towards Radha and Krishna whenever possible. That should be done. And even when a person has already become a grihastha and married, then still the need is there to do that. To do what? To offer one's heart to Radha and Krishna. Because ultimately, the deep satisfaction which we're all searching for is not to be found in a material relationship, even if the woman is a good devotee and a pious soul. That deep satisfaction cannot be found in a material relationship, unfortunately, or fortunately, I can say. Okay. The last point that I wanted to make which is a little bit different from the general theme of this class, but I wanted to just throw it in there, was that when I was at the manor, also there's one devotee named Shuti Dharma Prabhu, who was a brahmachari for close to 20 years, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. He's also from the Gujarati community. Yeah. In other words, he has an Indian body. And he's a very wonderful devotee. And a good preacher, and knowledgeable. He's like the leader of the life membership team at the Bhaktivedanta Manor, which is probably, in the West, the most successful of all of the life membership teams on the whole Earth planet, outside of India.